So ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. My name is Mark Purcell. I'm from the Australian Council for International Development, the body for Australian International Development NGOs. And this session, as you can see, is International Philanthropy's contribution to SDGs. And I did, as a good moderator, go looking for some jokes online to begin with. And I found some really, really good ones about Bill Gates going to hell. But unfortunately, because he is actually a benefactor of the Death Pulse Centre, I'll tell them. But I encourage you after this session to go online and you'll see them. Otherwise, we'll call this session I'd Give Anything to Be a Philanthropist. But the SDGs were agreements obviously signed by nation states last September to eliminate global poverty by 2030, and Australia signed on to that agreement, and preceding governments coming together in New York in September, there was a large International Financing for Development conference in Addis Ababa where the discussion was about mobilising resources to help achieve the SDGs, and it was acknowledged that official aid, development assistance, would be insufficient to the job, and that the large flows of global finance need to be harnessed, foreign direct investment, of course, and also philanthropy. Although, interestingly, in a 68-page outcomes document, philanthropy was mentioned just once. Nevertheless, there was a very substantial section on mobilising the business sector in engaging with helping achieve the SDGs, and I think today we're going to have an understanding of philanthropy that's quite broad, that does look at a range of different ways that different types of organisations or wealth can be accessed to help achieve the SDGs. And so we're using some terms around social impact investing and so on in that understanding, broader understanding of philanthropy. In the Australian context, I know just in the not-for-profit sector, philanthropy, so it's just under a $2 billion sector. The bulk of the funds comes from individual donors, and philanthropy sits at about 4%. So this is a very traditional trusts and foundations, but also corporate philanthropy. So it's actually quite small, but more broadly in the not-for-profit sector in general, moving away just from aid and development, it's about 8% and has been growing. So, but it still puts things into perspective that government funding and individual donations are still the main way of giving. We've got a fantastic panel today who have been doing some individual research on the role of philanthropy from an academic perspective, from a private sector perspective, and from a government perspective. And what I'm going to do is invite each of the panellists to just talk a little bit about their own background briefly and how they then came to be doing this current piece of research, but just to give you a bit of a sense of where they've come from in their professional lives. They're going to speak for about 10 or 15 minutes each. Then we'll take just questions on each individual presentation. And then at the end of the three presentations, we're going to open it up to discussion with you. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Rod Reed, who's the Managing Director of Ninty One Limited and the Cooperative Research Centre for Remote Economic Participation. So Rod, tell us about Ninty One and yourself and how you came to be doing this research.
Will do. And Mark, do I want to continue with my paper?
Or please do.
Yeah. Well, thank you everybody. Thank you Mark for that introduction. I spent 27 years working for a managing contractor, and many of you would recognise me from that time, but in the last 3 years I've continued to do international development work, but my day job is I'm the managing director of Ninty One Limited, which is an Aboriginal word meaning clever, because we are a research company. And Ninty One, it also owns a foundation, the Ninty One Foundation, which is, its purpose is to address disadvantage in Indigenous Australia, basically, but particularly remote Australia. And Ninty One Limited is a not-for-profit company that manages the Cooperative Research Centre for Remote Economic Participation based in Alice Springs. So thanks very much for the opportunity to talk today. Just keep going.
Yep.
Thanks, Jeremy. So when I was researching world's best practice in public speaking, I do a lot of public speaking as the CEO of a relatively big organisation, But the world champion public speaker for the last 2 years said on the internet, start with your theme. So my theme is that opportunities in international in philanthropy are bigger than ODA, and you need to get aboard. So my talk's a little bit about a call to arms. The second thing I learned on my internet search, the advice on giving a talk, was to hit the audience up front with a memorable fact. So here's my memorable fact. The value of private giving in Australia is bigger than Papua New Guinea's GDP. I'll come back to that. And the final thing, which I want to tell you now, we're meant to end up on a very powerful and profound statement, because apparently that's what people are most likely to remember when they leave the room. So to my research.
I'm sorry. I'll say next slide.
Next slide. No, back one, thanks. Okay. So, back one. Thank you very much. We're new at this. As Mark said, the estimates are that at least $500 billion extra is needed if we are to meet the SDGs per year. $500 billion. That's in addition to expanding ODA, increasing effectiveness and reforming tax systems and things like this. So we need to be more innovative about how we deliver the SDGs. So in 2016, I was fortunate enough to undertake a survey of 35 of the world, some of the world's, most of the world's biggest NGOs and managing contractors. So these are groups from Nikon Koei to Palladium here in Australia, all the big contractors here, the big ones in the USA, Chemonics, World Vision, Care, etc. And I interviewed the CEOs. So I had 1 hour with each CEO, but the main part of my research had nothing to do with SDGs or philanthropy, but it did enable me in those conversations to get some themes. And I came up with 4 themes. I'll come to them in a minute, but I'll use them as a foundation to address the title of this discussion, which is the international philanthropy's contribution to the SDGs. So first, let's look at philanthropy. What is philanthropy? And Philanthropy Australia's definition is, and I'll read it out, the planned and structured giving of time, information, goods and services, voice and influence, as well as money, to improve the well-being of humanity and the community. So that's PA, Meetings of Member of Philanthropy Australia. I'm going to concentrate on the monetary side because that's an easy thing to cover in 15 minutes. So how big is philanthropy in dollar terms? It's actually, next slide please, $31 billion were given by Australians last year. It's an incredible figure, but I've checked it, and Stephen Howells has checked it, and so has Kimberley. So we've done a fact check on this. It's bigger than the GDPs of PNG. It's bigger than the GDP of Zimbabwe, it's bigger than the GDP of Cambodia and Laos and many, many others. So it's a big chunk of money. On the right-hand side, private giving in the USA is a staggering $500 billion per year. And that's been fact-checked well as well. Now, you are an international audience. This is an international aid conference, so I guess you're thinking, so how much of that actually gets used internationally? So my next slide will show you that. But roughly, and this is active figures and surveys by the Giving 2006 project, which is a big chunk of research done by Griffith University. We believe about 1.9 billion Australian dollars is for international use. And the active annual report is a great further description if you want to chase it up. In the USA, that's very conservative. Some of the reports range from $15 to $19 billion, i.e. a lot more Australian dollars. So you're more, probably more familiar, I'm talking about billions and trillions and stuff. We're all familiar with the ODA. Right, so next slide, please. As Julie Bishop said this morning, surprisingly, $3.8 billion. We talked about our current $3.8 billion aid program. That makes philanthropy equal to 50%. Philanthropy for international use equal to 50% of ODA. And it's obviously catching up to ODA. Imagine that philanthropy is going up and ODA is doing something else. The US figures are there, and again, for me, it was quite staggering to see the amount growing for international use in America compared to America's ODA. So the ratio of Australia and America are pretty much the same, about 50%. That i.e., the land free for international use is about 50% of the value of the ODA. So back to my research, and to finish off, I published a article on the Dirk Pohl blog last week, so I won't repeat too much of that, but that's basically what I want to talk about. Initially, four findings. The first one was that international contractors who manage about $1 billion of Australia's aid at the moment do not participate significantly in philanthropy. But I think that's, talking about, there's great opportunity there. I think the potential for them to do so is very high because those private contractors speak the same language as a lot of the philanthropists, like particularly business philanthropists like Westpac, NAB, Rio Tinto, BHP. BHP and Rio Tinto are the biggest business donors in Australia. I'm certain that private contractors can talk their language much better than perhaps someone from an NGO. They work together on other areas of their businesses as well. Under the same heading, I'd just like to give credit to DFAT, of course, for the Innovation Exchange and all the good work that Julie Bishop described this morning by Data for Health, funded by Bloomberg, and a lot of the work by Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. The second finding was that NGOs and contractors generally work in silos, and I guess that's no surprise to anybody here. In the US, it's not quite so separated, and my observation is anyway that there's great benefits in that cross-pollination between NGOs and contractors. Thirdly, NGOs tend to put their information out in the public. It's publicly available all the time, whereas commercial contractors, not so much. I'm not having a go at commercial contractors, but I believe that philanthropists would benefit from knowing what commercial contractors can do. I think there's great potential for commercial contractors to approach philanthropists and say, hey, did you know, we did this, we're all currently in 100 countries, how about we work together? And when I did my survey, when I asked about trademarks and patents, etc., there was not one example given to me, and that's a standard indicator of innovation, is how many trademarks and patents you use at the stage. Finally, ODA and philanthropy are viewed differently. Obviously, the commercial contractors need to make a profit, and I made a paper in point in my paper that funders, or people are happy to pay doctors and lawyers when they're in trouble, but they're not so happy to pay aid work to the same degree. And my final point is that philanthropy should be viewed by contractors as a valuable market entry opportunity. Philanthropists have become wealthy. Andrew Forrest has become wealthy. They, in fact, have become wealthy by taking risks. They're risk takers. They're not constrained by government. And so I believe that there is great potential to get in there. My final and profound point, and powerful one, is philanthropy in my book is just the thin end of the wedge. I believe if more organisations become involved in philanthropy, they'll learn how to get into creative and innovative financing modalities like impact investing, which Jeremy and others are going to talk about more. But my final profound point is that Bloomberg and the New York Times have done an assessment that there's $2.2 trillion of cash sitting on the balance sheets of private companies in the UK and US alone. $2.2 trillion of cash. That cash obviously is competing for the best return on the investment. And 1% of that, estimated by an article in Huffington Post a couple of weeks ago, 1% of that would provide basic education access for all children in the world. So I'll leave you this final point that philanthropy is an introduction to what's possible in these innovative financing models like impact investing, social venture capital, and I think everybody should get aboard. Thank you.
Thank you. Before we move on, could I just say about this slide?
Could you introduce yourself, please?
I'm John Langmore from the University of Melbourne. What this slide shows, as far as I can tell, is that Australia gives about a quarter the aid privately, and the US gives about a third, and it's not neither of them are 50%.
Sorry, to explain, this bit here is approximately 50% of that bit.
Oh, okay.
This, I'm sorry, this is when the aid program was $5 billion. It's now 3.8, quote Julie Bishop, 9:30 this morning, and international use there is 1.9, so it's exactly half of that. So this
okay.
is
all right.
Good pick up. Thank you.
Yes, come on.
Kelly Mayor, just clarification, you gave the definition of philanthropy as being dollars and time and skills given. Is that figure just dollars, or is it a costing of the time and skills?
Good question. I come from a world where in kind is always added in as a dollar. This is actually dollars, hard cash, drop on the foot.
Okay, cash. So it's not in kind.
Not in kind.
Okay, so there'd be actually more then if you actually cost it.
Definitely. If you had voluntary time, work.
I've got another question up here, please.
Rod, yeah, I've got a question that I was going to actually ask at the end of it, but you partially answered it in your presentation, so I'll present it now. If I could just pick up on one point here from my accident, I'm Southern African and I'm actually Zimbabwean. I would imagine the Zimbabwean GDP, if they could find the $12 billion that's missing, currently missing in diamond revenues, you might get a slightly different answer, but that's besides the point. I started off my life in development aid, but then I worked in the IT industry and I spent a number of years working at Microsoft. And one of the questions, and I've now moved back into looking at this sector, and obviously the impact of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is substantial. And the question that I was actually going to ask, and you answered it, but I wanted to maybe get a bit more detail on how that was, is in engaging with those foundations, to what extent do you need to engage in the way that they would understand in terms of their KPIs that would have been expressed in the way that Microsoft was run, for instance, or the same with the other ones. And to what extent is that actually a problem in the aid sector and engaging in that market?
That's a great question. I think Jeremy's going to address some of those questions. So, use up the time. If I don't answer it, I'll come back for sure.
Okay, no, that's fine.
Sorry, quick answer. Yeah. My understanding, all the experience I've had, most of it's recently, is that investors will only undertake impact investing in those innovative financing models if first they can make a financial return.
Right.
Social benefits and the other benefits are secondary. Yeah. Particularly in the big funds in India, where there's a big market, and this is the Grameen Bank type model. First, you've got to demonstrate a commercial return, and then on top of that, you've got to demonstrate the social benefits.
Yes.
I've just got a clarifying question too, because the AFID stats, so the sector not-for-profits of about 1.9 million total raised, and 17% is coming from government DFAT, about 329 million. Another 60% is coming from individual donors. Under our categorisation, we've only got 4% coming from philanthropy, which is your very classic trusts and foundations. That's quite a narrow definitional. But you're obviously showing a bigger picture. You're sort of taking that individual donations, household donations as philanthropy as well, and other sources of income in your picture there?
Yeah, look, it's hard to set a long set of figures, but I'm taking it, I am including all the individuals. Sometimes they're bulked up by the United Church or by a particular cause. But by the same token, ODA is not all down the state of huge water supplies either.
So maybe this broader understanding of philanthropy, we're sort of talking about all resources mobilised through some sort of voluntary giving as opposed to a government allocation in this case, or it could be a corporate motivation. I was also curious in your interviews with CEOs. CEOs of not-for-profits and CEOs of for-profits have different motivations and drivers for engaging. Now, from NGOs, historically, it has been to access funds, but there's increasingly recognition around we need those professional skills and collaborative skills to enable us to get work done. And I'm wondering for the for-profits as well, were you getting a sense, well, traditionally, historically, for-profits wanted to collaborate with NGOs because they wanted the brand cachet of the not-for-profit, you know, to be alongside their brand. But are you finding different drivers, I guess? Did your interviews throw up those sort of...
Yes, they did, certainly. But I was interviewing CEOs of the big contractors, so they were obviously very focused on bottom line. And while I was interviewing the CEOs of NGOs, they were very focused on outcomes, development outcomes. You'd probably like to hear that. Yeah. So they're different drivers, for sure. But I guess one point I was trying to make is that the biggest donors in Australia, the BHP and Rio type, they understand the bottom line really well.
Yeah. Fantastic. We're going to come back and hear more soon. But let's turn to Sashini Mula and Terence Wood, both here at ANU. And I'm going to invite Sashini just to give a little bit about your background and how you came to be doing this research, and Terence also introduce yourself before you present the research.
Sure. So I'm actually a new student, and I was doing my finishing my bachelor's last year when I interned on the Terence at the Development Policy Centre, and they were interested in this topic, so I researched it and then the paper was written. I'm now doing Masters of Globalisation, so I'm here to present this.
Fantastic.
And I'm Terence Wood, I'm a research fellow at the Development Policy Centre. I think given that there's two of us and no working microphones, we might stand behind the lectern or I'll hand over to you later. Funnily enough, we're funded by the Gates Foundation, and one of our briefs is to gain a better understanding of Australian aid. Once upon a time, we'd envisaged that it would be primarily focused on gaining a better understanding of Australian aid over there in the field, but because the last few years have seen such turmoil in the world of Australian aid here in Australia, we've focused really quite heavily on the donor side of the equation. And we haven't just looked at the government, we've started to try and learn more about Australian NGOs and about how they operate. And the research that I'm going to speak to, or that we're going to speak to today, started with curiosity, really. And this curiosity was simply that Australian aid NGOs are increasingly using the internet as a way of engaging with the public. Think Facebook, think Twitter, think websites. And yet, this is not something that's ever been systematically studied in Australia. So we didn't, when we started this research, have any real understanding of how Australian aid NGOs use the internet, how they engage with the public through the internet, nor did we understand, nor did we know much about the factors that might have an impact on why different NGOs might choose different strategies from other NGOs. So we were curious, and from this curiosity, a research project was born. Before I go any further, I'll point one thing out. I think it's too late in the day for us to assail you with too much detail, so we're going to keep this brief, and we've very kindly got a discussion paper for those of you who would like detail. You can download it from the URL there on the projector. The other thing that's important to point out is that this research is purely descriptive. It's not intended to be prescriptive in any way. As good empiricists, we're just going out and describing the NGO world as it is. We're not here to hector NGOs with our beliefs about how they should be using the internet. All we want to do is describe. So these are the questions that led our research project. The first of them was, to what extent do Australian aid NGOs devote internet media space to the following ends: soliciting donations, raising public awareness about development issues, and encouraging the public to take action on development issues? The second question was, to what extent are different types of internet media used differently by NGOs with respect to the aforementioned ends? So how does Twitter compare to Facebook, that sort of stuff? The third question was, how much variation exists amongst Australia's aid NGO community and how they engage using the internet? Are all Australian aid NGOs the same, or is there a really significant difference amongst aid NGOs? And then the fourth question, a slightly different one, is that are aid NGOs that receive more money from the Australian Government Aid Program less likely to devote internet media space to raising awareness and to encouraging the public to take action on development issues? This question, as I said, is kind of different, and it emerges from an old debate in the literature on civil society, state relations. And many commentators in this debate have argued that civil society organisations, NGOs in this case, that become too dependent on government funding, lose their ability to engage in activist type work, and they lose their ability to critique the government because the government pulls the purse, the government holds the purse strings, and through that has the leverage and the ability to stop
that sort of engagement. Obviously, we couldn't speak to the whole debate in this research, but we were intrigued to see whether the predictions and the sort of main findings in the existing state civil society literature might be reflected in what we saw in the ways that different Australian aid NGOs made use of the internet. So the methods we used, well, we went through the following internet media of the largest 50 Australian aid NGOs. We looked at their website front page, we looked at their website get involved page, we looked at their Facebook feed, and we looked at their Twitter feeds. And for each of these media, we went through and we calculated the proportion of the media in question for each individual NGO that was donated to soliciting donations, raising awareness, and encouraging people to take action. We also calculated an average score for each NGO, averaged across all of the different media that we looked at. And then, to answer the fourth of our research questions, we combined the NGO internet media data that we had with other data on NGO attributes. Particularly, we took accident information on how dependent the individual Australian aid NGOs, each individual Australian aid NGO was on Australian government aid funding. As you might imagine, coding was a kind of complicated process. Things that looked at the start like they might have been ostensibly about providing information on a development issue often ended up, if you look deeply enough, with a donate button. So we had to navigate those sorts of issues. But we had clear rules for doing that, and we discussed judgment calls between the two of us. That's the background. Here's what we found.
So this pie chart shows our aggregate data, and it's averaged across all media types and all NGOs that we examined. So as you can see, we found that on average, most of an NGO's internet media presence is used to solicit donations. Awareness raising is less than half of what is devoted to donations, and then what's devoted to encouraging action is under half of raising awareness again. So that's the averages, but there is a lot of variation across NGOs and media types as well. So we've got a bar chart here that shows the variation across media types. Soliciting donations is the primary goal of all the pages except for Twitter, which is used mainly to raise awareness. But awareness raising is also a large portion of the Facebook page, although donations still take up most of the space there as well. Take action is quite low across all the pages, but as expected is highest on the Get Involved page on the website. We did expect, prior to conducting the research, that the Get Involved page would be used solely for encouraging action on issues, but even this page is used mostly to obtain donations. These box plots show our aggregate data averaged across all media types and shows the NGO's internet media use by purpose. So box plots are a way of seeing the spread of all the data points. So this shows the variation across NGOs. You can see the spread of the data points in the two horizontal lines. The top one is the maximum and the bottom is the minimum. And then you've got the rectangle, which represents the second and third quartiles. So in other words, half of all NGOs lie within that rectangle. Then the horizontal line across the middle of the rectangle is the median value. So these box plots show that the largest variation is seen in the amount of space devoted to soliciting donations, and the least variation is seen in the amount of space devoted to encouraging action on issues. Awareness and take action both had minimums of zero, so there was at least one NGO that didn't try to raise any awareness or didn't try to encourage action at all. However, donate had a minimum of about 10%, so every NGO devoted at least 10% of the space on their internet media to trying to solicit donations. In addition, half of all NGOs used at least 30% of their space for soliciting donations, but less than 30% to raise awareness and under 20% for encouraging action on issues. So we combined our data on how NGOs use the internet with data on certain NGO attributes, in particular NGO size measured by revenue, whether NGOs were faith-based or not, and the proportion of their revenue that came from DFAT. So this last attribute is the one we found most interesting and the one we'll really focus on here.
We used regression analysis on the data to explore the relationship between the attributes and the extent to which the NGOs wanted to solicit donations, raise awareness, or encourage action on issues. I won't go into any technical details of the regressions here, other than to note three points. First, the dependent variable in all the regressions was internet use averaged across all the internet media we studied. Second, the regressions are ordinary least squared regressions. And lastly, they are multiple regressions. So the coefficient for any one variable is that derived while controlling for other variables. So what you can see in these results is that there is no obvious relationship between NGO size and what NGOs focus their internet presence on. Nor is there a statistically significant relationship between religiosity and internet focus. However, there is a relationship between funding from DFAT and the extent to which NGOs use the internet to raise public awareness and to encourage people to take action. So I'll hand over to Terence here to speak more to that last point.
So we found a relationship, but the strange thing is we found a relationship that pointed in the opposite direction from that which we were expecting. For both awareness raising and encouraging people to take action, the correlations that we saw between funding from DFAT and the extent of internet media space devoted to these endeavours were positive ones. That is, NGOs that were more reliant on funding from DFAT tended to be the sorts of NGOs that devoted more media space to encouraging people to take action on development issues and also to raising awareness on development issues. So that was the opposite of what we were expecting, and it was certainly something of a puzzle. Before I get into the puzzle, I'll offer a few caveats and cautions. Like I said, we're good empiricists. The statistically significant positive findings that we found were only somewhat robust to alternate regression specifications. This leaves us in a position where we can say we're fairly confident we found positive relationships, but we're not extremely confident. What we are very confident of, however, is that there weren't negative relationships. So the findings that we expected on the basis of the literature were completely absent from what we could see in our data. The second point that's worth noting is that our coding categories were broad: take action, raising awareness. Perhaps if we'd used more highly refined coding categories, we might have found something different. For example, if we'd looked at the percentage of internet media space devoted to taking action in a manner that was particularly antagonistic to the government of the day, we may have found a negative relation rather than the positive one that we found with the broad categories that we used. Third, and this is an important point with practical ramifications, what we found were average positive correlations. Were positive correlations. We're talking about here about average relationships. Average means something that's true much of the time, as opposed to something that is true all of the time. So we are most emphatically not claiming that the Australian government never uses the leverage that comes from its funding to NGOs to change the way that they engage online, nor are we claiming that it will never make use of that leverage in the future. All we're talking about is average relationships, and for that reason, we wouldn't be advising Australian aid NGOs that they can go out and take funding from the government without having to pay any heed to potential consequences in the future when it came to the way that they engaged online. So it's perhaps a finding that's not particularly practically useful. Nevertheless, the positive relationship that we do find, at odds to the relationship we're expecting, does leave us with an interesting puzzle. It asks some questions that beg to be answered. We don't have any definitive answers for you as to why we see these positive relationships here, but because it's getting near the end of the presentation, we're happy to offer some speculation. One possible reason why we see a positive relationship between Australian government funding and the propensity of NGOs to devote internet media space to awareness raising and encouraging people to take action is that perhaps receiving this sort of funding from the government actually frees NGOs from the need to get money by any means necessary. And this in turn means that they don't have to festoon their websites with quite so many donate buttons. And that means that they can devote additional internet media space to other things that they care about, broader issues. So it's possible that we have some sort of accounting effect there. Another interesting suggestion that was made to us in comments on one of the blog posts we wrote about this is that perhaps it turns out that the Australian government is actually more tolerant of criticism and activism than the average suburban child sponsor is. And that because of this, NGOs that are really dependent on private donations actually have to be very careful in how they calibrate the tone of their websites, lest they put off relatively apolitical people who aren't there for the engagement with global issues, but rather simply because they want to buy the warm fuzzy feelings that come with making a donation. So that's another possibility. We're only speculating. We don't have answers here or definitive answers, but we do have a puzzling relationship that we'd like to look into further. For now, though, just to conclude, the short story is NGOs devote a lot of their online internet media space to soliciting donations. However, there is variation both across internet media types and across NGOs, and within that variation we found a positive relationship between government funding and the propensity of NGOs to devote internet media space to encouraging people to take action and to raising public awareness. So that's all we've got to say for now, although we're very happy to field your questions.
Thank you very much, Terence and Jenny.
Yes,
Debbie,
I had Nostal
Institute.
If it's about regressions, Debbie, no, you're not allowed to ask.
I hate to say it, but I'm only bringing it up because of the Terence and I know each other, because of the sign issue. So I did just want to ask, as a regression, as an econometrics techie, whether you said alternative specifications, did you actually look at a different model technique? Because it's a limited dependent variable, it can't take values less than zero, so OLS isn't valid. And that can change the signs. That's the only
thing.
Sorry, I just wanted to check whether there was an alternative specification.
No, I mean, basically we treated it as a continuous variable, and we didn't feel that it was bounded in the sort of way that would have required a Tobit regression or something. And the reason why we did this is that the distribution wasn't such that we saw a whole heap of clustering at either end, and similarly, because they're percentages, I mean,
it's not sort of right. I just wanted to check whether that could be one of the reasons for the signs. That's all I wanted.
I guess we'll talk about it more. Yeah. I'm open to the idea of running a Tobit regression or something, but I don't think this is the type of distribution that it would where there would be a particularly high risk of artificial truncation. But yes, you could be right, I could be wrong. We'll talk about it over dinner.
Other
it may not make a difference. It's unlikely to make a difference.
Other questions from these findings or observations? No? Well, thank you very much. We're going to come back and probe this a little bit more in the final part of our discussion. But let's move on to Jeremy Stringer, who's in the Government Partnerships team at BCAT. But Jeremy, how did you come to be, what did you do before you got into this bit of DFAT, and what do you currently do before you present research?
Yeah, thanks a lot, Mark. And thanks everyone for being here. Nice to see people walking into the room at 4:30 in the afternoon for the last presentation of the day. I know not why. Anyway, my name's Jeremy Stringer. I'm with the DFAT. I started working with AusAid in 2004, still work in the aid side, I guess you could say. I'm in the donor partnerships team. We previously were called the development partnerships team, and we manage helped to manage the relationships with the other major bilateral donor agencies such as USAID, DFID, Germany, etc. Now, when I came into the team a couple of years ago, I was given the USAID portfolio, but also the Gates Foundation, which is interesting in and of itself, in that we're a government agency and typically used to dealing with other government donors and NGOs, but not so much with philanthropic organisations. And the Gates Foundation has sufficient economic weight and sufficient power in world development or international development forums that it was felt that there was a need to engage with them and give them as much attention as we did to other major donors. Now, as a corollary to that work, we also thought, well, look, if the Gates Foundation is out there and engaging with us, who else is there? We know there's a few others, there's a few other big names, but what else might there be? And so that started an inquiry by me primarily to help to inform DFAT about what's going on in the world of philanthropy and international development. Thanks, Rod, you're ahead of the game. Now, the OECD reports that between 2003 and 2012, philanthropic flows from foundations to in developing countries increased by a multiple of 10, from about $3 billion to $30 billion. Other reports, such as from the Hudson Institute in 2013, suggest that number might be as much as $59 billion, although the OECD does say that's from foundations and NGOs, whereas the Hudson Institute just counts it as philanthropic flows, so probably including a large number of individual donations as well. But I think that speaks to the fragmented nature of philanthropic data and difficulties in collecting information and corroborating it to the extent you have a very scientific formula to put in front of people. So I would say that my research has given rise to a number of indicative measures, but none that were necessarily the scientific answer. Now, before I go on, and I'll point to my slide here, does anyone know what a triple threat is? Clearly no basketball players in the room. Well, let me tell you. So, triple threat is a basketball term, and it's been taken over by people in the theatre who say, you can sing, you can act, you can dance, you're a triple threat. It's a basketball term whereby if the basketball goal is over there, and I'm within range of it, the person defending me would be, more or less in front of me, and I have the ball in position, and I'm ready to either shoot the ball, I'm ready to use my skills and dribble around to get closer to the basket, or I can pass off to another person on my team to influence the game and try to get someone in a better position to score. So, next slide, please, Rob. So, I'd suggest that philanthropy has a triple threat skill set that they can potentially apply, or that they already do apply, but can potentially apply more broadly. They have an appetite for risk or innovation, taking those long shots, trying to score from a place that perhaps you might have thought you couldn't. They have a skill set, business skills, understanding of the market, where they can maybe create space and find a way to score. Or, again, they might have influence, like Jeremy, to pass the ball off to some commercial sector colleagues or even political sector colleagues, use their networks to influence the game. And again, try to make the impact that they are aiming to do. Now, I wasn't sure about using that analogy, but
can we skip the guy up here around the applause?
Yeah. For those who just came in the room, did you go get in? Now, I would argue that these characteristics are particularly important in our era where we're looking at the context of the 2030 Agenda and the Sustainable Development Goals and the necessity for partnerships to achieve those goals. Next slide, please, Rob. Thanks. So, the OECD's development report from 2016 uses this bar chart to illustrate the investment gap between what is currently the current resources being invested in developing countries as opposed to the resources that would be required to achieve the SDGs. Now, I'm sure there's already been a lot of argument about the methodology, but again, just for the purposes of my presentation, I'll use this as an example. Now, on this basis, at the same time as agreeing the SDG, the international community also came to a consensus that it was really necessary to look at all sources of potential contribution to harness all resources towards achieving these goals.
and philanthropists were recognised by the OECD. I think Mark, you said they were mentioned once in a report with the GPDC.
The Addis Ababa Financing for Development.
Right, okay. Well, in the OECD references philanthropy quite significantly in their 2014, 15 and 16 reports as having a potentially a strong role to play in actually achieving the SDGs. And I hope to illustrate a little bit why. Next slide, please. Now, unlike OBA, as I've mentioned, philanthropic data is quite fragmented and there's no central repository. So these figures that I'm showing are really just indicative to give you a flavour of the dollars out there. This is a list of the contributions of the philanthropic agency or foundations mentioned from 2010 to 2013 towards targets that were subsequently identified in the SDGs. Clearly the Gates Foundation is the outlier there. But that's not to say that the other contributions are insignificant. There's an estimated 200,000 foundations in the world, worldwide. Over 100,000 of these in the United States alone. I think figures from 2010 or 12 suggest endowments of about $650 billion amongst these foundations that are being invested to fund their philanthropic activities every year. In Australia, we've got over 3,000 foundations or organisations that could fit that criteria, which have a charitable or philanthropic purpose, and their endowments are about $4 billion Australian dollars a year, as opposed to the $650 billion. So again, you can see the dominance of US foundations here, the outlier being the National Postcode Lottery in Holland, which is a corporate philanthropy over there. Other big names that are not on this list that you might think should be, or maybe you've heard around, Bloomberg is one, often or all the time appears in the lists of the world's top 10, 20, 50 philanthropists. Same with Rockefeller. MacArthur and Packard are actually active in our region around climate and oceans. And then you've also got developing country philanthropists who are increasingly emerging and their names are being seen more often, or at least I'm seeing them more often, such as Carlos Slim from Mexico. King Sulaiman bin Abdulaziz Al-Raj is from, I believe, the UAE. And then there's Jack Ma from China, who's, is it Jeff Bezos from Amazon? It's kind of the equivalent between the US and China. Next slide, please. Now, the Australian government's recognised for several years the need to harness all resources to achieve larger scale and sustainable development outcomes. And the Foreign Minister announced the new aid paradigm in 2014, which really pointed to the benefits of engaging with the private sector in order to achieve development goals and shared value outcomes. The subsequent ministerial statement on engaging the private sector in aid and development also mentioned philanthropy and how philanthropy could potentially be a, Norway might be the wrong word, but an influential actor in working with the private sector. Next slide, please. Shortly after that, the government announced the innovation, or through the Innovation Exchange, $100 million US partnership with Bloomberg for the Data for Health initiative, of which Australia contributes $20 million. Now, I think one of the important points about this partnership is not just that we're working with a philanthropy. I mean, okay, you know, we work with various organisations to deliver outcomes, but it's really been highlighted to me that one of the reasons for deciding to work with Bloomberg, or you know, wanting to, was their global reach and their data analytics expertise, which enable better data collection and analysis to inform the governments which we're working with about health data, in order that those governments could then target their spending better. Now, obviously, there's issues in budgeting, but it's good to have information to base it on. This effort is an example of how the foundation's link to their commercial enterprise was able to help maximise the effectiveness of the effort. In that vein, there's been a term called, I'm sure many of you have heard it, philanthrocapitalism. It was coined by an article in The Economist in about 2006, and then a book about it. And essentially, philanthrocapitalism is philanthropists not just giving money, but using all the tools at their disposal to achieve their philanthropic objectives. So their private sector knowledge, their understanding of markets, and so on. Sure, they might provide grants, but they might do this as an example and then provide a loan, or they might take a stake in a company, for instance, a medical research firm, which has shown some promising signs, or they might provide guarantees. Now, one very high-profile example, next slide please, of that is the Gates Foundation, which has had an enormous success in expanding the access, production of and access to vaccines across the world. And there was a headline in The Guardian this morning about the Gates Foundation saving 122 million lives over the last decade. Now, that's not entirely true, but if you look at it, they certainly have had some big engagements through Gavi and through the Global Fund. Now, in this instance, for the pentavalent vaccine, the Gates Foundation... Sorry?
Pentavalent.
Thank you. The Gates Foundation worked with an Indian company that was producing it and essentially said, look, if you will produce, you know, expand your production by X times, we'll pay you a lot less for it. But if you can't sell it, then we'll pay you the extra cost. So they provided that guarantee and were able to expand production.
Next slide, please.
Thanks a lot. So philanthropic organisations also use commercial structures to help achieve their philanthropic objectives, and the Omidyar Network, for instance, has a foundation and a limited liability company in the US. And it uses this to provide an early investment in a company called Bridge International Academies, which was enabled them to prove their business model and drew in other investors and allowed them to expand further. Now, they serve more than 100,000 students in pre- and primary schools across Africa and apparently expand to Asia soon, according to the website. Another model is where a company might be working and the dividends, the profits of that company are actually funding philanthropic activities. For instance, the Ramsey Foundation is the primary beneficiary of a controlling interest in more than $3 billion worth of shares in Ramsey Healthcare in Australia. That was only as of 3 years ago from the death of its founder. But that $3 billion of shares, the dividend from that provides $50 million a year plus that the Ramsey Foundation invests to reduce poverty, and their website specifically refers to its desire to target the root causes of poverty. Next slide, please. So you might have heard recently about the Chan Zuckerberg initiative. So Mark Zuckerberg and his wife Priscilla Chan announced that they would give away 99% of the value of their shares in Facebook over the course of their lifetime. And they announced this in a letter to their daughter, which was put onto Facebook. Similar to Omidyar, they have two arms, the foundation and the limited liability company. Now, besides investing, what they've been very specific about is that having the company structure allows them to engage in lobbying in a way that the foundation, the charitable foundation structure in the US, does not allow. So they can lobby directly for public policy reforms, they can lobby for legislative reform and through funding political campaigns, and we all know how powerful and well-entrenched the lobby industry is in the US. I think to show just how serious they are about this, they recently appointed two people to very senior positions within their organisation. One was a former Republican presidential advisor to George W. Bush and also headed his presidential campaign. The other was a former advisor to Obama, who also headed Obama's presidential campaign. So deep links into both sides of politics in the US. It's going to be really interesting to watch where they go over the next few years. And just as an aside to that, I think to show where philanthropy can go, the Rockefeller Foundation, which was started with a endowment from Standard Oil, which subsequently became Exxon, is now effectively having a bit of a war with Exxon over Exxon's misrepresentation of climate science over the previous world, their claims of misrepresentation of climate science over the last decade or more. So just, I think fascinating. I think fascinating to see that development over time of how that influence of large philanthropic organisations can feed into the public discourse. Next slide, please, Ron. Now, I mentioned earlier the US $2.5 trillion gap between what is currently being invested to achieve the SDGs and what is needed to be invested to achieve the SDGs. While it seems enormous, this is actually only just over 1% of the value of global capital markets controlled by the private sector. So leveraging private sector networks to access, leveraging philanthropic networks to access private sector networks that can potentially help to provide the resources to achieve the SDGs is one avenue worth exploring. On the note of networks, so at the Paris Commission of Parties in 2015, President Obama appeared on stage with Bill Gates and announced Mission Innovation, which was a call upon governments around the world to double their spending on renewable energy by 2020. And Bill Gates at the same time announced the Breakthrough Energy Coalition, which is a group of billionaire philanthropists and venture capitalists with a combined net worth of $170 billion who are all committing to watch Mission Innovation's progress and to invest in the clean energy research results that show promise with potential to take to a larger scale. So that speaks to my point about using the political and private sector networks to potentially unlock resources for the SDGs. Next slide, please. So 200,000 foundations estimated, foundations worldwide and growing. I'd suggest that this doesn't capture a lot of data from developing countries as well, so there may be many more. Current philanthropic engagement in international development is actually quite limited, and I'd suggest it's just the tip of the iceberg of what potential there might be out there to engage. Donors are currently engaging foundations in various ways, but I think it's mostly in an ad hoc manner, including in the US, which has a much stronger and longer history of engagement with foundations. But there is a number of forums emerging to try to understand who the foundations are that are interested in engaging in the development spectrum and to understand what the opportunities are to work together. And these include forums such as the OECD's Networks for Foundations for Development, UNDP's SDG Philanthropy Platform, which is working in a number of countries, including Indonesia, Kenya, Uganda, and Colombo, if I'm not wrong, and the various business commissions for sustainable development and the SDGs. So, next slide, please. So I'll leave you with that. Philanthropy has the potential to offer a triple threat skill set for to contribute to the SDGs. They have the risk appetite to take a long shot over the soft, score a quick goal. They have business skills and understanding of the sector that perhaps other people don't have to be able to move around and find openings, opportunities. And they also have a network that they can potentially bring in to influence the environment that will contribute to closing that funding, that resource and gap. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Jeremy, and so for enlightening us about triple threats.